Welcome to the Better Money, Better World Show, a podcast project of Impact Capital Managers, or ICM. ICM is a group of investors who believe that by solving the world's greatest challenges, we will generate market-leading returns for investors while bending the arc of human history towards sustainability and justice. ICM members have backed companies ranging from Tesla to Coursera to Vital Farms. Collectively, ICM's 60 members manage over $12 billion. I'm your host, Daniel Pianco, a co-founder of ICM. My day job is co-founder and managing director of Achieve Partners, a leading investor in education and human capital. Here on Better Money, Better World, we'll explore the stories of our investor members, the companies we're building, and the limited partners allocating money to investors who don't just seek alpha, but also to leverage their capital to build a better world. Episodes will be released each week and feature a new guest telling their own unique investment stories, strategies, and perspectives. And we've got lots of great guests lined up. So, if you're excited about what this show might teach you about impact investing and the people behind it, make sure you subscribe to Better Money, Better World wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're feeling generous, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to highlight the work of impact investors and grow the community of impact investing. Now, with that out of the way, let me introduce you to our Better Money, Better World guests. Stephen DeBarry gave name to something we all felt inside, that geography plays a role in economic inequality. In his chart-topping TED Talk, Stephen talks about his investment philosophy in terms of the East Side. East Side gives name and understanding to what it means to live in a community on the wrong side of the tracks. Stephen gives great analogies to understand what East Side investing really means. And it's not just the lack of good restaurants with white tablecloths in East Palo Alto. Stephen breaks down how finding entrepreneurs in unlikely places can drive outsized returns for investors. But Stephen is also a limited partner, serving as a member of the investment committee at the California Endowment, giving him a unique view on how limited partners can expand their impact programs. Stephen is also a national track and field champion who tells the story of fearing the physical challenge of investing in a former Ironman World Champions startup. We're excited to have Stephen DeBarry, the voice of consciousness for many of Silicon Valley, on our show. Thanks so much, Stephen. Pleasure to have you on the show.
Great to be here.
As you know, we always start every episode with a fundamental question. What is a deal that represents who you are and your style of investing?
One of the deals I would point to is a company called Virta, V-I-R-T-A. And this is a company that's in the business of reversing type 2 diabetes, which is a really big deal for our investment thesis, our East Side thesis, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later. But, you know, we focus on marginalized communities. And in particular, you know, that idea came out of spending many years in a community called East Palo Alto in California, not far from Stanford, right across the freeway. And here's a crazy thing about East Palo Alto. There are only two places in the entire city you can eat with a metal knife and fork today.
Did the Four Seasons come in?
Well, that's one of them. So yeah, of course, the VC knows, right? Four Seasons, Quattro Restaurant, you picked one of them. And as you would well know, most people in the community don't show up in the Four Seasons. They don't hang out at Quattro. Only folks like us do that. And it's just not, a place that's trafficked by everyday folks. I'll give you a guess. The one other place you can eat with a metal knife and fork, entire city of East Palo Alto, go.
Like the IKEA? It's not IKEA. I'm trying to remember what.
You nailed it. That's actually it. IKEA cafeteria is the only other place in the entire city of East Palo Alto where you can eat with a metal knife and fork. Other than that, the dining options are Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, McDonald's. You know, there's several taquerias that are amazing, you know. But as a general matter, nutritional density in the city of East Palo Alto and in East Side communities generally is extremely low. And that has a bunch of consequences, but one of them is that diabetes is off the charts in East Side communities. Diabetes for people of color over indexes somewhere between 60 and a little more than 200%.
Wow.
It's crazy, right? And so one of the reasons I like Virta is because it achieves the goal that we seek as investors, which is to align the way a company generates its revenue with the way it generates impact. We want to see an incremental unit of revenue driving an incremental unit of impact. And so with Virta, it's really a fantastic story to a horrible problem. You know, the problem being that, you know, we've got well over 30 million people in the US who are type 2 diabetic, many more who are pre-diabetic. And despite the fact that last year we spent $404 billion managing the disease, I say managing because the reversal rate in exchange for that, you know, near $500 billion investment is 0.4%. Okay, so round that. And the answer is you can't reverse type 2 diabetes. That's what the usual suspects in the medical establishment will tell you. That is the standard of care, 0.4%. Virta, on the other hand, has a 60% reversal rate, 60% reversal rate. So this is an intervention that is literally 150 times better than the standard of care. And when you factor that with who has the disease, what we have is a scenario that is absolutely in the bullseye of our East Side investment thesis. And that is that, you know, as we sell instances of this intervention, we are making people healthier at a vastly, you know, more impactful clip than the sort of current regime in the medical establishment. And in addition to that, as the company grows, it is just an epidemiological fact by virtue of who has the disease. As the company gets bigger, you're necessarily having more and more of an outsized positive impact on those folks who over-index, you know, Black folks, Brown folks, Native communities. And so that's, in a lot of ways, what our East Side investment thesis is about.
This is a staggering statistic, that 60% reversal rate. How does it work, and why aren't more people using this product?
It's a fascinating story, actually. So the founder of the company, fascinating in a bunch of ways, you know, so the founder of the company, is an entrepreneur named Sami Inkinen. Here's a fun fact about Sami, incredible athlete. He was an Ironman world champion, like didn't do the Ironman, like he won it, world-class athlete. And while he was training, as most endurance athletes do, he was taking a bunch of endurance supplements. I did the same thing when I was a mountain climber and, you know, distance athlete, that sort of thing. They're all sugar. And so while he was a world-class athlete, you know, he also became pre-diabetic because he's taking all these supplements. And so he started to look at, you know, the range of interventions to treat himself. And he found a doctor at Harvard named Stephen Finney. And Dr. Finney had been running a clinic that was using a ketogenic diet and some other techniques to reverse diabetes. Sami, you know, put himself on Dr. Finney's protocol and lo and behold, reversed his pre-diabetic condition. And because Sami is who he is, you know, he reversed that condition, sort of swore himself off of these sugary endurance supplements. And after getting married, he put his wife in a rowboat under the Golden Gate Bridge, not far from where I'm speaking to you from now, you know, in San Francisco. And they rowed that boat to Hawaii with no endurance supplements, just food and water to show that it could be done. Set a world record. I mean, look, this is who this guy is, you know. So, you know, proves the point, sets the world record, and then comes back and goes to Dr. Finney and says, hey, you know, thank you for helping me, you know, treat my own condition. By the way, I know how to really build and scale digital companies. His prior company was a real estate company called Trulia that you might be familiar with. And, you know, he had a very successful exit from that company, very sophisticated entrepreneur. Went to Dr. Finney and said, you know, you've got this incredible protocol with these really impactful results. I know how to scale digital technology. Why don't we put our forces together and build a company around this? And so that was the birth of Virta. And, you know, they really are swinging for the fence in terms of scale. The goal of the company is to reverse type 2 diabetes in 100 million people by 2025.
Just real quick, like, how did you find, I mean, Sammy sounds like an amazing person, but he's kind of a, my understanding, you know, Stanford Business School type, like not necessarily who I expected you to pick as your, you know, best example of what you do, although what the company does is really amazing. So how did you find that deal? How did you kind of think through how someone like Sammy was going to impact the communities that, that you care about?
Well, say a little bit more about what you expected. Let's get that out and we'll work through all these pieces.
Well, I didn't know what the name, you know, when you started telling the story, I expected it to be like a doctor. I expected it to be someone who cared. It wasn't actually a racial or ethnic. I actually thought it was, I had in my head like a doctor who had a different approach to curing diabetes. And you come at me with kind of a person who, you know, it was a digital entrepreneur who like built a big company. And so I kind of expected at the start of the story to have a different kind of founder story. Yeah. And so, yeah. You know, I always view you as like finding, you know, we've known each other for a long time. And so I always viewed you as sort of finding that kind of like out of the way entrepreneur who's solving a problem in a way no one's expected to. And here's this guy, Sammy, who's like, right, you know, in the center of it, Silicon Valley style. So that's the disconnect that I was, you know, I view you as sort of the finder of amazing founder stories. So
yeah. Well, I mean, you just said it, right? You didn't expect it. Yeah. It was right in front of us. We're all venture investors, but I saw it in a different way. And so you're right. I mean, I also, we have known each other for a while. You kind of know how I get down, and I move in a lot of spaces that I think a lot of venture investors don't. A lot of my portfolio founders look different than your traditional, you know, VC profile. But I think the same can be true of your very traditional Silicon Valley investor. And what I'd say in addition to that is that's happening more and more frequently. You know, I'm noticing. You've got founders like Sami who have, you know, they're deeply seasoned. They have exits. They are post-economic. They can do whatever they want to do. They're not beholden to anyone. They can write their own script. You know, an entrepreneur like Sami could raise money from pretty much anyone he wants to and has his, you know, sort of pick of the litter in terms of investors and can hire very well. And, you know, all the boxes that I think venture investors want to check. But the thing that I'm seeing emerging more and more, and this has been true over the last decade plus, but it's really, you know, starting to accelerate, is entrepreneurs like that who have the most choice are actually being more and more driven by wanting to do things that are meaningful in the world. You know, they're not chasing dollars, they're chasing meaning. They are becoming parents or, you know, their kids are growing up. They, like I said, have covered their, you know, basic and even far more than basic economic needs. And it really is more about meaning and legacy, you know, for folks like that. And so, yeah, I mean, I connected with him through fellow investors, my friends at Obvious, James Joaquin and I, who had worked together previously. And at the time, Obvious was just getting going. And Sami was a venture partner with Obvious. And James said to Sami, like, hey, you should get to know Steven. He's working on stuff that is similar here. It's probably right up your alley. And so he and I connected. He's one of the very few people that, you know, when I connected with him, I was like, hey, let's go for a walk. Let's get to know each other, whatever. I was like, please don't say, let's go for a run. I don't want to run with this guy. You know what I mean? Like normal, just about anyone, I'd be like, yeah, let's go run. Let's go climb this mountain, whatever you want. I got you. Sami, I was like, no, man, let's go for a walk, slow walk, you know? But that, you know, we started talking and I got to know him and he was explaining what he wanted to do. And, you know, I had a chance to explain to him what our investment thesis was about. In the same way that I explained to you. I mean, we are focused on finding these areas of deep structural disparity in our society, like that 60 to 204%, you know, over-indexing for people of color with diabetes. Like that is structural. That is an artifact of this condition where you can only eat with a knife and fork, a metal knife and fork in two places in an entire city. That is not an accident. That is the result of legal segregation for most of our country's history. And that sort of structural reality spills over into the commercial landscape. And we have been lulled to think that these things are natural and they are not natural. And so this is the point of our work and our investment thesis. We look for those areas of disparity. And we look for profitable ways to invest to convert that disparity into prosperity.
So let's talk about that. I mean, everyone in our Impact Capital Matters group plays kind of a role. And I view you as sort of the conscience of our group. You have a tendency to get up and speak at our events and make sure we're all focused on the right things. I think everyone appreciates that. And you do a lot of the speaking with the TED Talks and everything else. And I know it's impossible to do this justice in a short podcast. And by the way, I recommend everyone watch the TED Talk because Stephen is amazing in it. Can you talk about what you mean by East Side communities and just, you know, in a nutshell, what does that mean to you? Where did that come from, that concept, yeah. And how does it impact your investing?
Yeah, I mean, I came to the term East Side because I actually moved to Silicon Valley from Australia, where I'd been, you know, living to build a business. This is like late 90s. And I didn't know anything about Silicon Valley when I moved here. I moved here for, you know, I had taken a job from abroad. And when I landed here, I was surprised. You know, I was looking for the valley, first of all. There's no valley, it's flat. But I had not seen another Black person for a year living in Australia, you know? And so when I got back here, I saw this community that had Black and Brown people. And I was like, oh, this is great. Like, I want to be there. I want to see these people. I want to understand, you know, like my folks. And I came to, because I had these beginner's eyes and just, you know, sort of a curiosity as an anthropologist, you know, I'm just sort of, I can't help it. I just think about communities a certain way. I was really fascinated by the fact that most of the Black and Brown folks in this community were sequestered together and they were segmented from the wealthy part of the community. So you've got Palo Alto on one side of the 101 freeway. You've got East Palo Alto on the other side. And, you know, if I had my old quarterback arm from high school, you know, I could probably throw a rock from one side of the freeway. And when it hit the other side, you know, the property would be worth three times more or less, depending on which way you threw it. And I understood that particular circumstance in East Palo Alto, but it wasn't until years later, I was managing a fund for the California Endowment. And at that time, the endowment had a focus on 14 cities in the state of California. And these were all lower income communities that were marginalized. And I remember one day I was sitting at my desk in East Palo Alto in my office, and I was looking at a sheet of paper that had the list of cities on it. And I saw East Oakland and East Salinas and East Merced and East Los Angeles, you know, and again, I'm sitting in East Palo Alto. I'm going like, what's going on with all these, you know, lower income communities being on the East Side? If we've got four cardinal directions, if things were random, you would expect for marginalized communities to be, you know, 25% in any given direction. But just anecdotally, that was not the case. And so I started pulling on that thread and just looking at it more and more. And over time, I started to realize, no, there was this pattern and it was not random. And that communities tended to be, lower income communities tended to be clustered on the east sides of places. And, you know, it took me years to figure it out, but ultimately I started to think about pollution and particulate matter. And again, going back to this idea that, you know, communities are designed by people, people make choices, you know, and I've talked a lot about basically a campfire metaphor, right? Like imagine you have 10 people sitting around a campfire and you need to keep everyone warm. But one of the things we know about the way that weather systems work is that wind blows from the west to the east, generally. So imagine you're sitting around this campfire, you got to keep everyone warm, but someone's going to get smoke blown in their face, right? And that is what kind of, that metaphor helped me understand what was going on at the community design level. You know, when urban planners and policymakers, you know, at city scale were deciding, you know, metaphorically, who's going to get, metaphorically and realistically, who's going to get the particulate matter, the pollution blown in their faces, you know, it was people with less power, which is why you have a Palo Alto and East Palo Alto and Oakland and East Oakland, you know, East LA and New Orleans East and East Side of Cleveland and Detroit. And, you know, I mean, it's a global phenomenon, Vancouver, Paris, you know, Jerusalem. I mean, it's a global thing.
Yeah. What I love about how you show kind of moral, you come up with these examples, like the, you know, how many restaurants can you eat with a fork, right. with metal cutlery, right? That's such a way of epitomizing it. Now, but you kind of conceptualize your investment thesis around this East Side concept. And so what I'm, you know, did you think about a, you know, why did you kind of create your own terminology for it? What was so important to you about that, that it kind of dominates your thinking today rather than sort of adopting an existing framework?
It's a good question, man, because honestly, it may have been faster to use existing frameworks, you know, to raise money and, you know, get to deals. But in the same way that I talked about, you know, the founding of Virta, I mean, this was someone reacting to his own circumstance. And so the building of that company has come from a very authentic place and, you know, has performed very well, I think, because of it. And I think the same has been true for our journey at Bronze, you know. They're really what the existing frameworks did not describe what is currently happening in these places. And so to use those frameworks to guide the work that we do would likely not do justice to these places. And so, you know, I made the conscious trade to go slower in the early days to get it right and to talk about a framework that actually describes the dynamic that's happening in these places. And the frameworks didn't exist precisely because most of the capital providers and investors and entrepreneurs don't think about these places, don't know about these places. You know, East Palo Alto in Silicon Valley is a place people go through. They don't go to East Palo Alto. And so part of the work that I'm doing is, yes, it's investment work. And yes, we want to deliver returns and we're doing well, you know, on those fronts. But part of the work here is also movement work. It's about giving language to phenomena that deserve attention. And so, you know, I'm glad to say now, you know, things like the TED Talk, I mean, they're, you know, 1.5 million plus people who've been exposed to this idea now. And I get Whereas I, you know, years ago, I had to go take someone, you know, it'd be a cocktail party and they'd say, well, what are you really into? And I'd say, okay, well, take your drink. Let's go in this corner. We're gonna have a 10-minute conversation. You know, now I can just say Eastside Community and people understand what that means. I get inbound, you know, messages from entrepreneurs saying, hey, I'm building this thing. This is why I think this is an Eastside deal. You know, we now have that shorthand. I mean, it's not dissimilar to the fact that we can talk about impact investing as a category today. I think when I started, and I think probably, you know, true for you too, like in the early days, we didn't really have a language to talk about what we were doing. You can say, and we still have work to do on the impact investing nomenclature for sure. But as a general matter, we've made a bunch of progress, you know, there. And so that's why I think it was important for us to build our own framework and our own vocabulary.
And what is the email, the random email you got saying, I believe, you know, I saw your TED talk, or I believe in the Eastside thesis, that became an investment, or became something that kind of triggered something in you?
I mean, we've had several. You know, the most recent is, we're about to close on a deal I can't talk about, but I will say probably the last three deals that we've done came in over the transom. One was introduced. The other was, they were folks that I knew, and one over the transom of folks that were sort of self identifying as Eastside entrepreneurs and strategy. So we've got a company in the nutrition space that has come in that way. We've got a company that is in the payments space, you know, that's in that category. And we've got an education and career oriented company, you know, that has come in that way.
It's a powerful metaphor, but it also has very real world implications. So how do you kind of report back to either your LPs or yourself that you've been successful in, you know, how do you kind of report that impact back out to people?
We report to our investors quarterly with a very robust annual letter. And our view is, you know, we try to stay abreast of the general impact measurement and management conversation. And have been there, you know, for much of the sort of current iteration of the impact conversation. I mean, back when, you know, GIN was being formed and IRIS and the, you know, early conversations of many of these frameworks. But one of the challenges of these frameworks is there's a balance between having the ability to compare across deals and even categories versus having specificity of understanding impact. And so for that reason, we try to stay abreast of the frameworks, but we're not attached to them. And really, we try to assess impact at the company level. Again, our investment thesis is moving disparity to prosperity. And so the way we look at it is, how is that happening at a company level? So for any deal that we do, we're asking ourselves, okay, well, what structural disparity is this company addressing? And how will we know if we're making progress? And we define that at the company level. And so the measurement is different for each of our portfolio companies. We can track progress based on the way we define that association between disparity and prosperity and how that moves over time.
You know, it's interesting. You commented, you know, sometimes we get wrapped up in the impact frameworks. Is if there's one thing you could change for, you know, the last 15 years, 10, 15 years of how the impact community has developed, what would it be that would have driven a lot more impact for us as a group? Is there something we could have done differently that would have made us more successful as a cohort?
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been a bit of dogmatic adherence to existing frameworks. And I think if there were more listening and maybe a little less talking from the folks who allocate capital, we would move faster as a sector. And I think there are, I mean, I can't tell you how many times, this goes back to your previous question about why did you build your own framework and why is that important? It's critical. And I think people are waking up to what we've been talking about for well over a decade. Like I'm not talking about anything new with the work that I'm doing. People are waking up to it now. And it's not for lack of talking about it, but I think by virtue and in some ways, because of the package that it comes in, people, you know, make assumptions. Well, it doesn't look like the way I expected it to, or it doesn't sound like, or your approach is different, or you're looking in categories that I either am unfamiliar with, or I simply have personal disbelief, you know, has substance or merit. If folks could suspend those sorts of judgments and just hear innovators out. And it's that suspense of judgment that I think is key, because as a sector, I think what we're all seeing different versions of is we need to do things differently. And at the same time, when folks come in with approaches or perspectives that are different, we're often penalized for that. And so it's the rare few who have the patience and the irrational passion to stick to their particular perspective for, you know, as long as it takes to make the point and put up the points and show the progress, you know, that will move us forward. But, you know, that swimming against the tide comes at an extreme cost, not just to the folks who are driving those innovations, but to the progress of the sector.
Yeah, it definitely feels like there's a lot, the nomenclature hasn't been developed in there. But the other part of it is there's so much to be changed, right? And you know, over the last few years, I'd love your take on something, which is that, you know, women in venture and sort of the impact community have created AllRaise and brought the highlight and focus on the fact that we don't have a lot of female representation in investing and in capital allocation. Over the last few years, we've had at the same time sort of the Black Lives Matter come into play, the movement, which is turning the focus and attention on marginalized communities of color. What does success look like for you as you kind of bring the East Side narrative to the fore? And how does sort of the spotlight swinging to impact, you know, compare as you think about women in impact or women in investing and women in capital formation versus, you know, communities of color and capital formation? Or is there kind of an alliance between the two?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And what I would say is we're in a really delicate and nuanced, critical moment. You know, I think for those of us who are of the vintage you and I are, you know, we remember the days when there were three TV channels, you know, like remember like Kung Fu Theater would come on that week, everyone on the playground was like trying to do Bruce Lee stuff, you know, like we all had that.
I was not cool enough to do the Bruce Lee shit, but yes.
But you tried. Come on, man. You know what I'm talking about. You know?
Mystery Science Theater or something.
Yeah. You know, but like we have that. You know, it's like I have no idea where you went to school. Right. Like, what, you right. know, right. I didn't no, know you
I, but I hear you. There were three channels and you had,
you know what I'm saying?
Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah. And that has been significantly missing, you know, from our society. And, you know, that changed last spring when we were all home sheltering in place due to COVID. And, you know, George Floyd happened and Breonna and, you know, Ahmaud Arbery and, you know, all these things that, you know, we experienced together. And so there has been, you're right, this mass awakening. And I think the challenge is to make sure that's a moment. I think we can all agree on that. I think the challenge is to make sure that is more than a moment. It becomes a shift. And so as it relates to the delicacy, the delicate nature of where we are together, because we are together, whether we realize it or not, right? You know, these movements, whether it's all raise and the focus on women, whether it is the secular growth and movement of capital towards environmental issues, which, by the way, have the most acute and outsized impacts on marginalized communities and people of color. Like, environmental work is East Side work, whether you realize it or not, that is true. And I think, you know, these dynamics are braided together. And so the kind of work that I'm talking about, you know, is also, you know, one of those trends. And so, yes, absolutely. Capital has been moving, you know, towards people of color in response to that moment and what I think is actually a shift, but I hope will remain a shift. But I also think there's an important point to be made, because I think I've seen any number of corporate announcements, for example, by very well-meaning people and boards and so forth that make proclamations about moving dollars to people of color and Black folks specifically. And I think that's fantastic. I also think that it is important to think about, you know, as we sort of articulate our investment thesis, what's the alignment between the way a company's product or service generates revenue and how it creates impact? Because it is possible to move capital to people of color who are building products and services that are not additive on that dimension. And don't get me wrong, I think as a response to the history that we share, moving capital to people of color is in itself a positive thing to do. But what I'm saying is, if we want to be most impactful, we can move dollars to people that have been historically marginalized, women, people of color, et cetera, and make sure that those dollars are moving towards products and services that in and of themselves, as those businesses grow, are creating the kinds of impacts that we want to see in the world.
100%. And so we can't replace sort of racial, almost like we can't replace racial justice with sort of the broader economic and sort of social justice issues that we face. And so, you know, how do you measure success then? I mean, like, how do you come back to the impact question, right? You said, hey, we can't use the old frameworks, got to listen to people's consciousness. But like, all right, how do we allocate capital to companies and general partners that accomplish that mission? And how do we evaluate success in the context that you just described?
Yeah, I mean, again, for us, I think it's, you know, some of this is framework and approach and strategy, and some of this is the, you know, the soft part of the game. And, you know, for us, I think a lot of it, you know, one of the reasons that investing in diverse managers is important is, you know, around this, the soft parts, like why are you even investing, or why as an entrepreneur, why are you building, you know? And I think in our experience, some of the entrepreneurs we work with are building because they have a deep understanding of these communities and the issues that folks in these communities face, and therefore are best positioned to address them. So I think about one of the founders I love working with, Phaedra Ellis Lampkin. She's the founder at Promise Pay. Her story is an important and fascinating one. You know, so she started building a business that was focused on addressing the inefficiencies in the criminal justice system. So you get a parking ticket, you know, it's really hard to pay that ticket. That turns into increased fines. You know, you gotta have a court appearance. You're a low income single mom. You know, you don't have transportation to get to the court. You miss a court date. Now you've got a warrant for your arrest. You know, you go into the court to try to, you know, deal with this, and you have to take off from your job. Now you miss a day at work. You're at risk of losing your job. I mean, like, just the actual penalty I mean, let alone financial, but just from the stress and lived experience of going through that system for folks in that circumstance, it's just, it's unduly severe. And so she started Promise, the business, to address those issues. But one of the things that we saw as they started to have success with providing technologies that help people pay, you know, things as simple as parking tickets and, you know, things like that, was that as they made these criminal justice systems more efficient, they were unintentionally making those systems more predatory. So they would take the savings that they didn't spend on courts and, you know, these sorts of things, and they would use that to go arrest more people. That wasn't the point of this, right? And so to come back to your question, you know, we have a fundamental value at Bronze, which is that we think that love is a competitive advantage. And I think, you know, an entrepreneur like Phaedra exemplifies this in just beautiful ways, because I remember having these conversations with her as the business was starting to, you know, succeed against its original plan. But to her great and important credit, she paused as an entrepreneur and said, look, the business is working and we're starting to get more customers and demand and, you know, all that, but we're having these adverse impacts that we didn't expect, but we can see them. And we don't want to be in the business of making these systems more efficient, but more predatory. And so she paused the business and took a hard pivot and had to rethink what she was doing. That was an incredible singular act of entrepreneurial courage. And it is precisely the kind of thing that no entrepreneur would do without having a deep love for the community and the people they serve with their product or their service. And so I commend her, but I will tell you, she made the pivot and found a new business, which is actually focused on facilitating payments for government services, and just closed a $27 million Series A. You know, that was announced last week. And they are on an incredible path as a business that I don't believe they would have found but for the deep love for the customers that they serve. And so when you get that kind of alignment, I think it's not only the right thing to do, but it really is turbocharging their business. They are closing customers, you know, much faster than I've seen in government sales and any other business. The business, I mean, the demand for this business, I'll not go into all the numbers, but suffice it to say, her round was handsomely oversubscribed. The prospect for the business looked incredible. And I think she got there in large measure because her and her team actually love the folks that they're building product for.
That's such an amazing story, because I think too often, you know, you invest with the best intentions and then you wake up 5 years later or 10 years later and, you know, you're Facebook and you're wrestling with all these kind of unintended consequences of what your product has wrought. So that's an amazing, amazing turnaround story. But hard to evaluate and hard to track. So it's to your point, listen and love, right? Is that the answer?
Well, let's pause on that though. I don't know that I would agree that this is hard to evaluate. I think the evaluation criteria are different, but I can tell you, super easy to track. Again, for us, we're looking for that alignment. You know, where is the disparity? How do we move it to prosperity? So, you know, the business they're in today facilitates payments to government entities and others, but, you know, mostly government customers. And so, for example, late utility payments in the city of Louisville, Kentucky, grew almost 30x after COVID hit. These are just everyday people from all walks of life who were hit by the pandemic, you know, in Louisville, just like they were in most parts of this country, almost everywhere. And people need relief. And when you look at the dominant pay and collection regimes, the way the products have been built assumes nefarious intent. People don't want to pay. That's not true. People actually want to pay. They just don't have efficient and effective ways to do that. And so because Phaedra and her team at Promise have the understanding of what people actually want, they do want to do right. They want to pay. They realize that if you make it easier for people to do so, you meet them where they are, you send them a text message, you give them a mechanism to onboard to the product, you give them a payment plan that allows them to actually make those payments. Guess what happens? Like, the utilities are seeing much higher repayment rates once you, you know, structure the product the right way. So absolutely easy to track in terms of what, you know, the performance, the repayment rates are what we look at now. And those are through the roof. But the point that I'm making is, I don't think you get there with product unless you actually love the customer, because there are things that will not be obvious unless you have that level of commitment to the customer, that level of intimate understanding of their life experience. And in that regard, it's just good business.
Well, it takes someone to sort of stop what you're doing that is somewhat successful in order to sort of take a right turn to do the right thing. And in the end, find something even better, right? Which is kind of what you did, which is, you know, I think why all of us do what we do, right? Because we do have an impact by allocating capital to folks. One last question, as you think about, you know, I'm really want to get your, because you're also an LP and a GP. And so before ending, I just want to know how this conversation ropes into how you function as a manager of an endowment as your side hustle, and how it impacts kind of how you relate to your LPs and how you allocate capital as an LP relative to being a GP.
Yeah, I mean, the thinking is essentially the same. I mean, we are driven by this East Side investment thesis at Bronze. And that thinking need not be limited to our firm. You know, I mean, this is a broader question for our society. You know, like, will we look squarely at the structural disparities that have been architected into our society, the decisions that were made, the decisions made by people, more specifically, right, that have been architected into our society? Because if we do, it, you know, we will also understand that we have the opportunity to re-architect, redesign those systems. And can we move those disparities to prosperity? And so, you know, to your question, as an LP, you know, in some of the top venture firms in the Valley and, you know, others that I interact with, I'm asking this question, you know, hey, as you all are looking at deals, you know, what role can you play in building products, building services, supporting entrepreneurs that make the kinds of decisions that Phaedra made, you know, and there's a business case to be made for that. And then, you know, from an endowment perspective, I think it's also important to understand that applying this East Side thesis in venture capital is just the tip of the spear. We can move disparity to prosperity through all asset classes. And so as it relates to the endowment conversation, that's a way to frame it. You know, how can we use the full complement of capital flows to make that move from disparity to prosperity? That's the East Side thesis. I think that's how we get to a more just and joyful society. And it should be that. It's, you know, more just and importantly, more joyful. You know, we really enjoy this work. We are having a ball with the entrepreneurs that we're working with. Our LPs are great supporters and down with what we're doing. And you know, I think there's, you know, the more fun we're having, the more joy we have, the more it accelerates the work and it brings more people to it. And I just couldn't be more grateful for, you know, all the support that we've enjoyed and the growth that's coming to this idea.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end than that kind of notion. So, Stephen, thank you so much for making the time. I again encourage everyone to watch the TED Talk. And Stephen really is one of the most inspiring people in our space. So thank you very much for your words of wisdom today.
No, it's thanks. It's really great to be here with you, and I appreciate the time.
This is Marika Spence, Executive Director of Impact Capital Managers. Better Money, Better World is made possible in part by ICM, a nonprofit network of over 60 best-in-class fund managers investing for superior returns and meaningful impact across North America and beyond. Our members share a passion for partnering with entrepreneurs and scaling companies that will realize a more resilient, equitable, and sustainable future. If you enjoyed today's conversation, tune in for the next episode of Better Money, Better World. Tell your friends and visit us online at www.impactcapitalmanagers.com.